So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod,
episode 57. Oh, it's nice to be back, hunkered down in the shed with wet and windy weather going on outside.
God, it's been absolutely biblical. The weather has been...
has not been.
Absolutely torrential rain, yeah.
Yeah, so. It's not been very nice, which is going to be my excuse. I don't know what my excuse is every other episode, but it's going to be my excuse for not having any catch-up because the weather's been so horrible, I have not been out and about to do anything interesting.
No, obviously the weather's been pretty bad. I did go to the Wetland Centre yesterday, which was quite nice. Saw great white egrets. What else have they got there recently? They've had snipe there recently, which is really cool.
That's obviously, that's in Arundel, isn't it? Because there are lots of wetland centres.
Yeah, sorry.
Arundel Wetland Centre.
It's one of my favourite places. It's only 10 minutes up the road and it's just great. Been there, but I have been building. I spent most of the week in front of a computer building an e-commerce site for a bird in the lens. So I'm putting a whole load of products on. Initially, Curlew products, because I'm hoping to sell some product and donate a percentage of the profits to Curlew Action. Goes in hand, of course, with me becoming a Curlew Action ambassador.
Or Captain Curlew, as we now like to call him.
Captain Curlew, which is now my official title. And it's so time-consuming. I've been making products, photographing products, editing and building a shop. So that's been pretty all-inclusive last week. So anyway,
I was going to say, nice short catch-up, because it's probably going to be a long-ish episode, because we're sitting here with a lot of information.
Yes, we often talk about this could be a short episode, but actually this one could be a long episode, so we are giving you pre-warning, because we seem to have rather a lot of stuff about. The beaver. We are going to do an episode all about beavers, which are one of our favourite animals, aren't they?
Yeah, and they've popped up in quite a few of our episodes because we've spoken about reintroductions and we've spoken about ecological engineers and keystone species. Yeah. And so they've been sort of name dropped with little facts and projects and stuff throughout quite a few of our episodes, but they've never had their own dedicated one, and we felt like that was an injustice that
they deserve one.
Needed to be rectified, didn't it?
So it definitely did.
And today we will be chatting all about, well, beavers, but specifically the Eurasian beaver that we get.
There are two species of beaver, just so I'll just throw that in first before you get in.
Oh, what are they? Do you want to rattle off the two species?
The two species of beaver are the Eurasian beaver, or Castor fiber, and the North American beaver, which is Castor canadensis.
That's good.
I think that's how it's pronounced.
I feel like every episode has me mispronouncing scientific names.
Well, I've probably mispronounced that. But
so it was time for you to have a crack at some of them. So we'll obviously be focusing on the Eurasian beaver because it's most relevant to where we are. And obviously it ties in nicely with our tendency to talk about reintroductions and threats. But before we get to sort of the loss of the beaver and then subsequent bringing back of the beaver, we might as well talk about what they actually are and delve into some of their biology. This is where I've ended up with a lot of information because they're really quite interesting.
Absolutely.
Quite interesting animals.
There's so much to talk about. But off you go. You start.
So where to begin is the question. So they are the largest rodent in Britain. Beavers as a whole are the second largest rodents in the world, the first being the capybara. The North American beaver is slightly bigger than the Eurasian, so it means our beaver technically comes in third, but as a group they are second largest. They're pretty easy to identify. I think they've got very distinct characteristics, mainly their big flat paddle-like tail, which I think is probably the easiest way to
Definitely. Some people actually say that they were confused with otters sometimes because obviously they're very different in shape and size. But I like this little description. Beavers are large rodents about the size of a tubby spaniel with a stocky body and short legs.
Oh, see, the problem is I don't know dog breeds well enough to know how big a spaniel is.
Or a tubby spaniel even. So I quite like that.
Yeah, that is good. It surprises me with the otter. I guess they're both brownish mammals, but obviously otters are famously quite long and sleek animals.
I think it's probably when they're seen in the water. Yeah. You just see the head in the water and the body going, you know, as they're diving down, and maybe they're confused in that way. But
whereas beavers are quite sort of stout with quite, you know, let's say short legs, as you mentioned. Typically they're somewhere between sort of 70 to 90 centimeters long, and they weigh about 12.5 all the way up to 38 kilograms, so they can be quite chunky. Like I said, they're sort of not as sleek looking as an otter. They've got quite blunt heads, small ears, small dark eyes that are sort of protected they're protected underwater by clear eyelids known as a nictitating membrane.
Sounds all right.
Nictating?
Yeah, sounds all right.
That's what I'm going for.
I'm accepting
it. But it's sort of like a third eyelid that keeps their eyes protected while they're underwater. Obviously, so I'm going to just go into a little bit about their cool biology before I go into their sort of the taxonomy and evolution, because the biology, I think, is the stuff that really sort of I find really interesting.
Off you go.
So a bit like rodents in general, all rodents, they've got those really prominent, sharp incisors. Beaver teeth are actually orange due to their enamel being reinforced with iron-containing compounds.
Yeah, I never knew that. That's a fascinating fact. In fact, that comes into a little bit of my mythology later, so I'll culture, I'll talk a bit more about that.
They really do capitalize on that sort of rodent typical big front teeth for gnawing, and obviously they tear down trees with them. They're covered in really dense fur that traps air when they're underwater, which keeps them really nice and warm.
I've got a fascinating little fact about that. They actually have the second most dense fur in the animal kingdom, but which has the most dense?
I don't know. Because I'm trying to think of aquatic mammals, and I feel like a beaver would be more dense than an otter, but perhaps not.
It is actually the sea otter. The sea otter has the most dense fur in the animal kingdom. The beaver has the second.
I guess that makes sense, actually. If beavers are, which I haven't even really touched on their ecology yet, but obviously beavers are of your freshwater, sort of rivery species, whereas a sea otter's venturing out into the cold sea.
I guess that does make sense.
I did have a fact about their fur, and I was going to make you guess, but I actually just think it's not a very fair thing to ask you to guess.
Go on.
I was going to ask you how many hairs per centimetre squared do you think a beaver coat has?
It's going to be a lot. If they're the second most dense in the animal kingdom, it's going to be a lot. But what
is a lot of hairs per centimetre square?
Per centimetre square, I reckon they've got...
I've got a range between
two numbers. They've got between 500 and 1,000.
Between 12,000 and 23,000 hairs per centimetre square.
Square centimetre. That's why they're... pretty dense.
Yeah, so Blight, how many
has a sea otter got?
Anyway,
that's incredible.
That's just on their amazing fur. They've got a whole bunch of really interesting sort of adaptations for their life underwater. So their nostrils and ears have valves that close. Obviously, I've already mentioned the membrane that covers their eyes. The one that I found particularly interesting is to protect their larynx and trachea from essentially water flowing into it, is that the epiglottis is contained within their nasal cavity rather than in their throat.
Wow.
Which obviously makes it a lot easier to sort of shut off from water. Also, which is, again, really quite strange, is that a beaver's lips can close behind their incisors, which prevents water from going into their mouth as they bite into stuff underwater.
So isn't evolution an amazing thing?
Yeah, it's mental to think they're sort of shutting their mouth while still being able to bite into stuff.
That is incredible.
Again, perfectly adapted to what it is that they do. Their, let's say, very characteristic flat tail actually has more functions than I thought. Obviously, you see the way they swim. They sort of use it to propel themselves through the water. It also provides them with like support when they sit upright to chew down a tree. So they sort of lean on it, which I think is quite cute. Acts as a rudder. It stores fat for winter. It has countercurrent blood vessels, which allows the animal to lose heat in warm temperatures but retain heat in the cold temperatures. So it works as a thermal regulating device.
Like I said, it's an evolution, an amazing thing. And I didn't realise, until you actually see them out on the land, just how flat their tails are. They really are, aren't they?
And they also slap it against the water to make a loud noise to scare and warn off.
Yes, it's like a warning,
animals,
isn't
it? Yeah. Again, very multi-purpose tail.
Yeah.
One of the coolest appendages I think mammals have evolved is the beaver tail. They're not particularly fast, especially not on land. In water, they swim about sort of 5 miles an hour-ish, and only their webbed back feet are used to swim. The front feet sort of fold under their chest in a cute little...
Like a doggy paddle thing.
So they're not actually used for swimming. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. Oh, okay, back on their funny mouth adaptations, the tongue can create a waterproof seal at the back of their mouth as well. So they are...
perfectly adapted to living in water, aren't they?
And they can hold their breath for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Although rarely dive for that long, but it's still an incredible ability. A little bit on their sort of general... lifestyle, I guess, what I quite like is the fact that Beavers are very family orientated animals. They sort of live in these little lodges that are composed of an adult male and a female and a monogamous.
They mate for life.
They do. little pair and their offspring. I like the fact that the beaver families can have up to 10 members, and they might even have to make multiple lodges to accommodate that many family members. They've got little communities going on.
Yeah, because actually they make lodges and burrows, don't they? So they'll burrow on the riverbank, but they'll also make lodges within their dams as well.
Yeah, so at certain times of the year when a full dam and lodge isn't sort of needed, or they haven't built a dam, or they're not needing a lodge, they will just create burrows on the land. Interestingly, those burrows, when they're not being used by beavers, are really useful homes for things like otters and other sort of aquatic mammals, like water voles and stuff will also steal old beaver lodges. So I feel like, well, I'll tell you what, I'll touch a little bit on their ecology and then I'll talk about their history.
Oh, and they are crepuscular, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I was just going on to their ecology.
Damn, I just jumped in there.
So yes, they are crepuscular, which means...
That leads you into it, doesn't it?
They're nocturnal and crepuscular. So crepuscular being dawn and dusk activity. They are herbivores. There's always been a prevailing myth in certain communities that they eat fish, but they do not. They feed on... Well, actually, their diet changes slightly depending on the time of year. So during the sort of spring and summer months, they are feeding a lot more sort of herbaceous plant material, which I had to get in there because I love the word herbaceous.
And that's... Actually, I read a really good thing. One of the things that they do eat is Japanese knotweed, which is a non-native, very, very
invasive species.
Aggressive species, which, of course, you know, if you have Japanese knotweed in your garden, you're unlikely to sell your house ever until you've got rid of it. So it's a very bad thing to have.
It's particularly bad for our rivers.
Particularly bad. And beavers really like Japanese knotweed, apparently.
So spring, summer, it's a lot more sort of plant material, leaves, roots, ferns, grasses, water lilies, rushes, even things like cattails as well. But it's in the winter that they sort of take on the characteristic that people know them for most, because they eat a lot of really woody material. So they eat literally bark and the woody parts of trees and shrubs, especially things like aspen, birch, oak, willow and
willow.
Alder.
They love willow, don't they?
Yeah, interestingly, and this is, oh, I'm jumping the gun here, but interestingly, willow... do you know what? I'll save it. I'm going to save it for the ecosystem engineer part. And yeah, it's a little teaser for what's coming up next. So yeah, their diet changes during different parts of the year. They start to build dams when they hear running water. And there's been a variety of studies done, and they don't like the sound of running water. It literally triggers their dam building behavior, which, as we were talking off her podcast, I find particularly amusing, because it's like they hear running water and think, I've got to put a stop to that right now.
I did see your little reel about that.
Yeah, from a long time ago. And it's probably evolved, this disliking for the sound of running water, because if they've already built their dam at a lodge, then the running water is a leak. And so it means, oh, we need to fix the leak. And so they think that's where that sort of disliking for the running water has come from, because they need to go and fix their dam. And so that triggers them to go and repair it. I'm not going to go too much into dam construction. I went down a bit of another rabbit hole of how they build dams, but it would take me like 10 minutes to go through it. So I'm not going to go through it. What I will do is leave a link to some cool videos explaining how beavers build their
dams. Yeah, but
there's
a reason why they do as well. They're very multifunctional, their dams, because one of the primary reasons for them to construct a dam is that they slow the flow of water down, which creates deeper water, and then extremes in water levels are avoided. But that keeps the pond level really stable, and their lodge and burrow entrances submerged. So that protects them from predators. So there's really good reasons why they do the dam building.
Yeah, it's really cool when you see them go underwater to enter the lodge, because, like I say, the normal terrestrial predators are not getting in there, and they're sort of tucked away underwater.
Yeah.
So just very quickly, dam construction begins normally in sort of late summer, early autumn. They repair them whenever it's needed. If you watch the maintenance, it's almost constant to try and keep it
I'm not sure
running.
They ever sleep. They all seem to be working all the time.
Yeah, and
As in busy as a beaver.
And then just as a really, really quick fact, I found it mental that beavers can cut down trees that are sort of up to 15 centimetres wide in less than 50 minutes.
Wow.
It takes them less than an hour to
get through
that.
That's incredible, isn't it? To gnaw through a tree, that thing.
They also alternate whether they're gnawing on the left or the right side of their mouth to try and keep it even. They also pause to listen to the sound of what's going on inside the tree to work out when it's about to fall, to make sure that they're not in the way when it falls. So you'll see them chewing, stopping, and then sort of just pausing and they're just listening to the structures inside the trees cracking, which again is incredible. I mean, their eyesight's not particularly good. It's their other senses that they really rely on.
And their teeth are really important. In fact, they obviously get worn down a lot, but their teeth never stop growing.
No, apparently. Like, yeah, same with all the rodents. They're
they're always growing and always repairing and coming through again.
But yeah, I won't go too much into the dam construction, unless there's anything else you want to say on their ecology and behaviour.
No, I only wanted I think you mentioned the term earlier on. They are a keystone species, and a keystone species is a species that plays a really critical role in creating thriving ecosystems from which all of the wildlife benefits. Yeah. We call them ecosystem engineers,
yes,
don't we?
Which we have a whole section on.
We have a whole section on, and we'll go on to that in a bit.
Yes, well, shortly, but I just thought, and this again, rabbit holes. I have a bit of a problem with rabbit holes, but I went down just looking at sort of the origins of beavers. So they belong obviously to the family Castridae, which is part of the rodent sort of group. And they first appeared as in rodents, and this Castridae family appeared in the Paleogene period. And the earliest, what are known as proto-beavers, emerged in the late Eocene, which is about 38 to 34 million years ago. And these really early ancestors were basically just small, generalised rodents. They didn't have the aquatic traits or wood-cutting abilities that we think of as typically beaver. And I always find it interesting because rodent as a group are particularly diverse. And so you had these sort of generalised rodents very early on, and then they just split off into all these different niches.
Yeah, I didn't know that porcupines were rodents.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's
until
cool,
I did this research.
Yeah, and you've got obviously massive capybaras and all sorts of different rodents out there. So then during the Oligocene, God knows if I'm pronouncing these correctly, which is 34 to 23 million years ago, you start getting quite easily recognizable castorids, which is your sort of beaver group. These were still mainly terrestrial, but starting to look more beavery. They looked a little bit more like ground squirrels rather than swimmers, so not climbing adapted squirrels. But they started to show signs of specialised gnawing, strong jaws, enlarged incisors and things like that. They did live in sort of woodlands and river margins, but they didn't build dodges or lambs. Lambs? Dodges or... Wait, dodges or that, dams or lodges?
I'm going to have to leave that in.
Oh, dear. Dodges or lambs.
Yeah.
apologies for dodges or lambs. I'll start to go through this a little bit more quickly, but what I wanted to get to was that during the Miocene, 23 to 5 million years ago, is when you started seeing these major transitions towards the sort of semi-aquatic lifestyle that we associate with beavers. And again, they started to develop these slightly more streamlined bodies, paddle-like back feet, the dense insulating fur. They did start to burrow, typically more in the riverbanks rather than, again, we've spoken about having both on land riverbank burrows and then the underwater homes as well. You can just see me avoiding trying to say lodges or dams from now on. But they're thought, and like you mentioned, they thought that this probably evolved, the water usage probably evolved as a way of escaping predators.
Yeah.
Building an underwater home is a great way to avoid predation. So that's thought as a potential hypothesis for why they then became so reliant on aquatic behaviours, which I thought, again, quite interesting to think what drove them into the water.
Yeah, and actually, talking about predators, they've the people believe they've got no predators at all, but foxes, for example, will take the kits, which are obviously the young beavers. Domestic dogs as well will. Pine martens too will sometimes take kits, and birds of prey, but even... You think they may be safe underwater, but large pike will also take
they'll
the
take
kits.
Anything, though, won't
they?
Yeah,
absolutely.
They
so but they've got very few predators, really, or very few, a small risk from predators because of the lodges in the dams.
You mean the lambs and the dodges?
I nearly said it then.
It's hard, isn't it? But the reason why I've gone into, I don't normally go into such depth of the evolution, but the reason why I wanted to is it led me to talk very quickly, and it's a real tangent to our Eurasian beaver, but I just was taken slightly by the giant beaver, which was found in North America during the Pleistocene, 2.6 million to 10,000 years ago. And I liked this line in an article I was reading. It represents one of the most dramatic experiments in beaver evolution, because...
It was about the size of a bear, wasn't it?
Yeah,
so
they
it was
were
absolutely huge.
Up to 2.5 meters long and weighed between 100 to 120 kilograms. So much bigger than our modern beavers. Yeah. Despite the giant size, they actually had much simpler teeth. They didn't really show any evidence of building dams or anything like that. They lacked the sort of skull and tooth structure that would allow them to be quite so good at taking down big woody trees. They're thought to have fed more on sort of soft, watery vegetation.
Yeah, because there's
like
a little
that.
Bit of a debate also about why they went extinct, whether it was human intervention or whether it was because of the changing climate and the loss of vegetation and what have you. But I guess we'll never really know.
Yeah, it's hard. They there was a little period of time where lots of megafauna started to disappear, and it coincided quite a lot with some sort of hominid evolution, but it also coincided a lot with changing climate.
Yeah.
And so there's something called the overkill hypothesis, which basically puts a lot of the guilt on human sort of evolution and wiping out megafauna. But a lot of them took thousands of years to become extinct. And so there's also a thought that it might have actually just been the dramatic change in climate, really. But just very cool to think there were bear-sized beavers roaming around, a bit like the giant sloths. I just find them really, really interesting.
I wonder if they made a massive dam.
No, I'd said they weren't dam builders. There's no evidence for
it. Oh, they weren't
anyway.
Dam builders, right.
But yeah, so it was this the period in the, it's called the late Pleistocene extinctions. Basically, lots of megafauna, like mammoths and mastodons, all went extinct as well. And then the last thing I'll say is while beavers themselves, like as a group, these early beavers, started in North America, it's not 100% confirmed, but it's believed that the modern beavers, the two species that we speak about or we spoke about earlier, started actually in Europe. So back when there was still a land bridge between the two continents, the early beavers would have come over to Europe. The evolution that happened in sort of the Eurasian area was the beginning of what we now call the modern beavers, but they then would have migrated back to North America. And then since the continents have split, the divergence between them is massive. They have different numbers of chromosomes, all sorts of things. So they are very distinct species, which happens when you basically divide a population and they can't interbreed anymore, which the Atlantic Ocean did quite successfully.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, two distinct species.
Did you say that the North American beaver is a lot bigger than the Eurasian?
I don't know whether I'd categorize it as a lot, but it is bigger.
Mm.
Which is why it's the second largest rodent. But yeah, so the modern beavers originated, they believe, in Europe. And so, yeah, I've got mitochondrial DNA studies that are linking the common ancestor between these two modern species at about 8 million years ago. And yeah, so the ancestors of what is now the North American beaver would have crossed the Bering land bridge about 7.5 million years. So there's been about 7 million years of evolution between these two species, but they've adapted to very similar niches and lifestyles. But I feel like that will do as a quick rundown. I mainly use that just as an excuse to talk about giant beavers.
Yeah, well, why not?
Just because I thought it was just really, really cool.
Okay, well, obviously I mentioned they're a keystone species. So should we talk now about why they're so good for the environment? So why are beavers important to the ecosystem?
Oh,
lots to talk about, isn't there?
Yeah, this is their sort of real highlight reel feature, isn't it?
They ecosystem are, engineers, we love that expression.
They're commonly called the only animal alongside humans that have changed or can change their environment so significantly and so rapidly. And this is all down really to their tree felling and dam building is where they're able to change the environment. So, I mean, humans coppice woodlands for a variety of reasons, but that's essentially what beavers do. They coppice woodlands around rivers.
Yeah.
And that act in itself, even before you've built a dam, has all sorts of benefits. So it allows vegetation that wouldn't normally get a lot of light because there are trees growing to suddenly get a lot more light. So you get a much denser and greater variety of vegetation growing, more shrubs and things like that, which, as we've spoken about so many times, more plant diversity, more habitat diversity.
Yeah, more
just
invertebrates,
means more invertebrates,
more bird life, more amphibians.
Yeah, more birds, more bats.
Yeah.
More light also reaches the water, which is shown to benefit things like amphibian breeding and freshwater invertebrates as well. And then what I think is quite often overlooked is the felling of trees obviously creates deadwood habitats, which is, again, invertebrate havens and fungi as well. So all the way down to fungal populations, everything is being boosted by this coppicing of beavers. And then obviously you move on to building dams. And as you mentioned earlier, the deepening of the pool is really important for them for hiding essentially the entrance to their homes. But it slows the whole flow of water through the river. And I mean, this basically leads on to all the other benefits. And I've got it sort of broken down into a few. So flood defense is a key one. Holding back water essentially allows the water to be released more slowly. It stops really dramatic changes in water levels, especially downstream. So you're going to have areas with lower water level. It's not all going to rush in when there's high rainfall, for example, and burst the banks. It's going to be nicely released slowly throughout the water system.
They're absolutely brilliant for that. And do you know that the UK government spent $26 billion on flood defences in the last, I don't know how many years, but it's an extraordinary amount of money on flood defences for rivers bursting their banks. And it's absolutely been proved that beavers will mitigate that.
I'm pretty sure, here's the news article, I'm pretty sure I mentioned it in one of our episodes. I think it might be one of our positive episodes about beavers beating governments to build a dam in Czech Republic. And I think I have mentioned it, but I'll say it really quickly again. Essentially, the headline was that beavers had saved the Czech taxpayers $1.2 million or £1 million by flooding a protected former army training site where essentially there was supposed to be a dam to create this wetland and everything, and the planning permissions, everything got stalled, and beavers turned up and did it so quickly that the government now don't need to build a dam.
That's amazing.
And they built a wetland with pools and canals. The area is roughly twice as large as the one that was planned by the government. And beaver family moved into a gully, built a nice dam. Great nature reserve now for wildlife, and it saved the taxpayers a lot of money.
Well, that's amazing. And you talk about wetlands, they create rich wetlands, of course, that support fish, birds, amphibians, and insects. And of course, wetlands store carbon. So healthy wetland soils store carbon. And of course, you know, we all need that at the moment.
Yeah, that slow moving.
Well, the world needs that at the moment.
That slow moving channel of water sort of around their dams, say, creates wetlands because it allows the area to flood.
Yeah.
Obviously, which we can mention, I think you've got a bit on the opposition to beaver reintroduction. There can be problems with that. But when it's done properly, it attracts the insects, the fish. It also attracts birds and all sorts of other mammals. With the flood, going back to the flood defence, beyond just slowing the water, it also acts as a sponge, which helps filter out a lot of pollutants and things like that. When, especially in times of flood, when you'd normally get topsoil containing all sorts of like agricultural pollutants rushing into the water, the dam will be very effective at sort of filtering that out. It also recharges water tables, all sorts of things. And then going hand in hand, as they always do, droughts. They're great for mitigating the impacts of droughts because all that water held back is very, very useful when there's a period of low rainfall and high temperatures. Also, that deeper pool that we mentioned they create, not only is it less susceptible to evaporation, it stays much cooler, which is really important for fish, especially things like trout, and that need these deep, cool pools. During times of high temperatures, when all of the rivers are quite low, they will seek refuge in these deeper, cooler pools. Beavers create them perfectly.
Yeah, and talking about the trout, there was a study, it was done in Canada actually, there was a study of a Canadian river catchment found that where beavers were active, there was, during drought, there was 60% more open water present during drought than there had been prior to the beavers' return. So early research of British beavers, the reintroduction of the British beavers, indicates similar benefits. So brilliant for drought.
Yeah, they are incredible. And what I thought was quite interesting, and I actually hadn't seen this mentioned, was the impact that essentially the wetlands and watery dominant environments that they create can have on things like wildfires. Because not only do they provide sanctuaries for a lot of animals during times of wildfire, because there's still this nice wetland area or deep watery pools that they can literally hide in, but those wetlands create huge barriers for stopping the fire spreading. You know, if there's a woodland, particularly dry, on fire, as soon as it hits a very waterlogged wetlandy area, it's not then going to be able to spread. So at a time when wildfires are becoming ever more sort of prominent, and we're seeing them more and more, especially in summer, things like wetlands created by beavers will be a huge boost in protecting the land from fire.
I think also it's just the whole mosaic of habitats that beavers engineer. And there was a Devon beaver trial that was being done. And in, there's a little sentence here. In a few short years at the Devon beaver trial, activity by beavers had already created a mix of wetlands, ponds, deadwood, open grassland, scrub and trees, plus areas of sphagnum moss. And similar results have been found elsewhere. And of course, that mosaic of habitats supports such a wealth of species, dragonflies, butterflies, brown trout, salmon, as well as bat, bird, reptile and amphibian species. And it's not just that overall numbers increase, so does the variety and the rarity. So they've created that in just a few short years. You leave beavers to do their thing and they can help nature just recover at such an incredible rate.
Yeah, it is remarkable.
They're amazing animals.
That's probably a really nice summary of all of their engineering. The one thing I found interesting, or I think worth noting, is that because beavers have sort of evolved or co-evolved with a lot of nature in the UK, they live quite symbiotic lives together. So things like willow, we mentioned that they eat a lot of willow. Because it's evolved with beavers, it doesn't actually die when a beaver gnaws through the trunk. That gnawing action actually instead stimulates regrowth of new stems and increases the structural integrity, which then goes on to benefit all the insects and birds and stuff that want
it's
to live.
It's just like pruning, isn't
it? Yeah. So you
like
think
pruning a tree.
That they're chopping down and killing all the willow. It's actually quite beneficial for all the rest of the wildlife. And willow has evolved to handle that in a different way. So it all works beautifully in this system.
I love that. I love the way that nature just works together like that.
It's the same you often see, and I don't know whether you have this in your sort of opposition facts, but you often see people saying, oh, building dams from beavers, for example, would be bad for migratory fish because human-made dams are a real problem for migratory fish. But because beavers evolved alongside these fish, the fish can bypass beaver dams very, very easy. They can't jump massive concrete ones, but they evolved together, so it all works in harmony with each other. So
there's a little thing there. It says because I was just about to talk about that actually. Some of the opposition to beavers was the fact that the migratory fish, such as salmon and trout, might not be able to make it past the dams. But the fact that these fish co-evolved, like you said, over millions of years with beavers before we obviously turned up. And then it says, in fact, it's likely the beaver taught the salmon how to jump, which I thought was really cool.
That is good.
Not
like
actually
that.
Taught, but obviously the salmon learned that they had to.
If the beavers evolved the dams first, the fish that were able to jump were the fish that survived until eventually you only have a population of fish that can jump.
Yeah, it's not really the beavers going, right, come on, you get a bit of speed up now. Jump. It's not
that's
sort
a
of
nice
that,
little bit of
anyway.
Natural selection, really.
But
isn't
there are some opposition to beavers, which is why we'll talk about the reintroduction project a little bit later on. And obviously, took a long time actually with feasibility studies and what have you to get the government to license beaver introduction or reintroduction. Obviously, there was a lot of opposition from farmers, and of course, intensive agriculture has pushed the use of the fields close to rivers, closer and closer to rivers. And so, beavers, as we've said, will create little wetlands and they can destroy crops by flooding that field. Because, years gone by, that field wouldn't have been so intensively farmed.
Yeah.
And now it is.
And where we've spoken about, obviously, the dam holding back water, which benefits, reduces the flooding downstream, obviously, directly around the dam, if you raise the water level, it will burst its floodplains. But then floodplains are such a vital part of a river system. Yeah. Like I say, historically, they wouldn't be farm fields. They would be floodplains where the river periodically bursts its banks and the water goes into the ground. Whereas now, if you randomly stick a dam right next to a farm and it floods a field, someone's going to be a little bit upset about it.
Yeah, and the floodplains are important, which is why we're building houses on floodplains now, which is causing another problem with flooding.
A whole other topic.
That's another whole other topic. There are other opposition. Beavers drastically reshape landscapes, which conflicts with traditional managed land use and can be seen as disruptive. Concerns exist about beavers spreading parasites. I guess we had the same thing with badgers and bovine tuberculosis.
Yeah. Although that's a bit of a myth.
So the parasites like tapeworm, I'm not going to get this right, Echinococcus multilocularis. I'm not going to try and say that again, which apparently can be spread to dogs and humans. And obviously, some landowners see beavers just as a general nuisance. They're quite messy in the way that they you know, take stuff down and, and create areas of dead wood and what have you.
Which, but obviously we spoke about, is so beneficial. And I can't remember whether this has come up in an episode of ours or not, but there was a whole push not that long ago about leaving, like, our parks, for example, less curated. Because, say, like the parks in London or your city parks, they're very rigorously managed, kept clean and tidy, so it looks nice. But really, fallen trees, leaves on the ground, it's all really good. So what the beavers are doing is great. You want dead wood. You want a messy woodland. It shouldn't be nice and pristine and sort of tidied. But that doesn't necessarily fit our use of the land.
No, and typically, I guess, we've talked about land change use quite a lot. Obviously, intensive agricultural changes and what have you. And, of course, those two are conflicting a little bit. The reintroduction of beavers and intensive land use has obviously caused a conflict. So I think that's where I finish now on the kind of opposition.
It is the main one. The only one that pops up, and we may have done this in a myth-busting episode, is, again, and I mentioned it right at the start, the angling communities do sometimes get upset by the idea that beavers will eat fish. They don't eat fish. They only eat vegetation. There are a few, again, angling groups that get upset with the changes that beavers cause because it might disrupt their favourite fishing spot. However, the counter to that would be, in general, beaver presence massively improves fish population. So if you do want to fish, beavers are a good thing. You just might have to move. But
I think probably the biggest one was the stop in the migratory passage of salmon and what have you.
Yes.
The possibility of that happening.
Sometimes these opposition sort of positions appear based on general misunderstanding of beavers, which I guess they've not been around for a long time. And I think you've got quite a bit on their extinction, but you can see why people would perhaps forget what beavers look like and what they actually do. Because, I mean, I've never seen a beaver in the UK. I've only seen one in the south of France. So
very briefly, we just saw one that afternoon, didn't we, down that little, it's sort of almost like a ditch.
Yeah, so it's not a common sight. Yeah. People aren't going to grow up knowing about beaver behaviour.
Yeah, but we'll talk about reintroduction because obviously there are more and more being introduced.
We've still got to talk about their extinction.
We've got to talk about their extinction. I've got a bit of, I'll try and be brief on the mythology and culture.
So I went a little bit overboard on the history of beavers.
There's not masses of mythology and culture. The beaver's been used to represent productivity, obviously productivity and trade, tradition, masculinity and respectability. The English verb to beaver means working with great effort, being busy as a beaver. Although it has a typically wholesome image, the beaver's name has been used as a sexual term as well. I'm pretty sure during Spring Watch, when they're talking about beaver action, they do with a little bit of a smirk on their faces. I think that, you know, the people watching will also have a little smile on their faces because you automatically think of that, don't you?
A very famous Great British Bake Off clip where one of the cakes was made to look like a beaver and took up, and Paul Hollywood went, right, well, tell us about your beaver. Yeah. And no one held a straight face.
No, exactly. So sadly, the beaver has been associated in that way. So there's been a lot of sort of historical references to castoreum, and castoreum is an oily substance that that beavers use to mark their territory.
Yeah.
It's a scent marking secretion that comes almost like from the anal gland. But I didn't realise how much that has been used and how much that has a bearing on their extinction.
Yeah. Vanilla, isn't it?
So, since then, it's been used as a powerful medicine, a treatment for everything from epilepsy to constipation to spider bites. Roman women inhaled the fumes of smouldering castoreum in an attempt to induce abortion.
Oh, blimey.
Francis Bacon, I learned a word when I was doing this research, the 16th century English polymath. Do you know what a polymath is?
Oh, a polymath, is it somebody with lots of different skills?
A person with extensive knowledge and expertise in many different subjects. I would imagine that Stephen Fry is a polymath.
Yeah, like a polyglot is somebody who can speak lots of different languages.
Exactly. So he recommended snorting a bit of powdered castoreum as a cure for brain fog, apparently.
Do you know what? This is a real tangent, but I would love to know what it is about human instinct to find something and decide to snort it.
I know.
Because we've done it with a lot of things, and to just find a random scent and be like, do you know what? I reckon if I snort that, all sorts of good things will happen. It's a weird
thing. And I'd also like to know how people first discovered the fact that castoreum could be used as a base for perfumes, which was being used all the way up into the 20th century. It's being used as a base for perfumes.
It's like the whole whale vomit, amber. I think mum told me off saying ambergris, ambergris.
It's weird.
Why would you think, oh, that would make a good perfume?
Castoreum could be found in beverages, baked goods, ice cream, particularly vanilla and strawberry, candy, and especially in chewing gum, which I didn't know.
Oh, I didn't know that one.
The Algonquins, I think that's a Canadian term. Traditionally, you dusted their tobacco with dried castoreum. And in the 20th century, so did cigarette manufacturers like Philip Morris, which gave Camels. Camels was a cigarette brand, and it had a very distinctive smell and flavour. And that was dusted with castoreum, apparently. Other things in mythology and culture, the front teeth of beavers are so strong and sharp that Neolithic and Iron Age people used them as woodworking tools.
Well, that makes sense.
Gold-mounted beaver incisors have been found in Anglo-Saxon burial mounds. This one we talked about earlier on. Beaver meat's also been popular, and the paws and tail were eaten by Catholic monks on Fridays. The church believed that beavers qualified as fish rather than meat, so they could be eaten over Lent.
It's like a little loophole, isn't it?
They thought the same thing about otters, because they did the same thing with otters.
It's a cheeky little loophole, really.
But there was things like a damaging notion was the belief that beavers eat fish, and which is a total fallacy, as we talked about earlier on. But C.S. Lewis's The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe did an awful lot of damage to that perception, because there were two beavers in that, Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. They were friendly, hospitable, and they shelter the Pevensey children soon after they arrive in Narnia. And in fact, I think they also led them to Aslan, the Great Lion. However, those lovable beavers in the story were portrayed as eating fish. And Lewis was no doubt completely unaware of the damage this did to beaver human relations.
I don't
and many
that.
People even today are very hostile towards beavers, fishermen being one, because they mistakenly see them as competition for fish.
I always think that once they get into Narnia that they meet Mr. Tumnus and he takes them.
No, apparently.
I completely forgot about the beavers.
Apparently Mr. and Mrs. Beaver did that. What else have we got? Beavers featured a lot in Native American folklore. Modern ecologists dubbed the beavers the Earth's kidneys, as they play such a vital role in freshwater ecosystems.
That's cool.
What else have we got? I think that might be it, actually. My sort of
culture and
cultural
mythology
stuff. So with that, talking about castoreum, we could that sort of go, oh no, hang on, there's a little bit. Sorry, surnames. Apparently there are 1,106,572 records of beaver surnames.
That's brilliant.
That's good, isn't
it? Yeah, that's great.
The surname beaver is of English origin, derived from the Old English word beafore, referring to the animal beaver. As a surname, it likely originated as an occupational name for someone who hunted or trapped beavers, or as a topographic name for someone who lived near a place frequented by beavers.
That's really cool.
And so that name reflects the historical presence of beavers in the English landscape and the importance of their fur in the medieval period. Now that will
that
go on to...
Lovely,
that leads
it?
Lovely into, obviously, into their extinction.
Yeah, so we've been gushing about how brilliant they are and how much we love them as an animal. So now it's time for the little bit of sad news about what we did to them before we then go on to the good news about what we're trying to do to...
They were eradicated from Britain by 1789. I think the last one was recorded in 1789, and they were pretty much wiped out up until then, obviously for their fur, which was used to make hats, coats and gloves, but also for their meat. We talked about 17th century Catholic Church leaders ruling that beaver was a fish, and so they got hunted for that. And again, they got hunted for this yellowish oil, this castoreum. And this oil was in such demand for use in early cosmetics that the value of a single beaver in the Dark Ages was equal to an entire year's earning for the average peasant.
Blimey.
That's one beaver. Isn't that incredible?
That is mental.
I'll read that again. The oil was in such demand for use in cosmetics that the value of a single beaver was equal to an entire year's earnings for the average peasant. Consequently, they got hunted to extinction. Castoreum has been utilised in perfumes and flavouring agents in foods, which is what we were talking about earlier on. But there were still beaver populations across Europe, although they've gone extinct in Britain. So by the earliest 20th century, there remained only 8 relict populations, totaling about 1,200 individuals. And they were located in Belarus, Ukraine, Lower Rhone River in France, Elbe River in Germany, some in Mongolia and China, and in Norway, three regions of Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, for example, the last beaver recorded in England, which they did through like radio carbon dating of beaver gnawed stick demonstrated that they survived in the River Tyne up in Northumberland until about the 1300s. The last beaver record in Scotland, which was around Loch Ness, was in the 1500s. It was a little bit earlier in Wales. The last evidence of beavers in Wales was 1188. So still, it was a long time ago that we did this.
I think 1789 was the last recorded one, which was up in Yorkshire somewhere.
But, yeah.
And by the time of the First World War, only a tiny remnant of populations of European beavers remained in the mountainous reaches of eastern France, Germany and Russia. But then since the beginning of the last century, they've been, across Europe, have been granted legal protection across a growing list of countries, not here at the time.
No.
And consequently, they started to stage a remarkable comeback, and that will lead us then nicely into the reintroduction of beavers.
Yeah, and it's one of those bittersweet things, I think. It's so lovely that they are being reintroduced, and we could honestly have done an entire episode just on the reintroduction projects because, again, heartwarmingly, there are so many going on trying to bring beavers back. The bitter part of the bittersweet is the fact that it's been such a challenge and it's still, you know, a lot of these projects that we will go on to talk about are within enclosures and things like that. It's not like they are just free roaming again across all of Britain and protected and all okay. So it's having to be very carefully managed. And I understand that that has to be done, I guess, to protect their image, but also to protect landowners and things like that.
Yeah.
They can't go and flood all the farms. But it is another story of conservationists having to work incredibly hard to just scrape out a bit of space for our beavers.
Absolutely. And I read, I think I've made reference to Roy Dennis in a number of episodes.
Especially the white-tailed eagle episode.
He's one of my wildlife heroes. And he wrote a book called Restoring the Wild. And he does a little section on trying to help to reintroduce beavers. And what came across in this short chapter, I mean, read the book Restoring the Wild as a book anyway, because it's amazing. But what came across was just how long the feasibility studies took to actually grant any kind of permission, you know, to do even a trial reintroduction. It took, you know, you think, a couple of years, but it was over a period of sort of 15 to 20 years of due diligence and campaigning and talking to governments and councils and landowners, and it just took so long to do, but it did happen.
Yeah, I think any of the episodes where we've touched on reintroduction, we had a whole episode, didn't we, on successful reintroductions. It always comes with that battle to actually get it underway and permissions and legal loopholes that you have to, or hoops rather, that you have to have to jump through. But thankfully, there are now quite a lot of projects out there trying to bring beavers back to Britain.
I think it was only 2021. Plans to reintroduce beavers into the wild in England was set out by the UK government in a consultation in 2021 as part of moves to help tackle the nature and climate emergency. So I think, having said that, I think this... No, I'm not going to get political. Stop.
Yeah, we don't do politics.
We don't do politics.
I mean, you know, Scotland beavers were given protected status back in 2019, for example, and there were new measures around 2021 with the Scottish government trying to actively support the expansion of beaver populations. England beavers have been given protected status, and this was in October 2022. Essentially, they were added to the European Protected Species List, and there was a management framework, which I think you touched on, but essentially means that landowners or the managers of land have to follow quite specific regulations and obtain a license to resolve any conflicts they have with beavers in their area. So they can no longer sort of just go out and shoot them or remove them. But onto the more positive stuff, we've got a few examples of some of the really cool reintroduction projects. And one of the questions that actually Mum asked us before we came in here was where the reintroductions of beavers came from, like where were we sourcing them? And so a lot of them, especially the initial ones, came from Norway. Essentially, the Norwegian beavers were chosen because they were shown to be quite genetically similar to those that lived in Britain, and so with sort of thought that they would adapt quite well to life over here and wouldn't be too jarring for them. So they sort of provided quite a nice source for the beavers to be reintroduced. And the first ones ever to be re-released in the UK was at the Ham Fen Beaver Project in Kent, which again sort of kick-started this whole movement of bringing beavers back.
Yeah, and actually, again, going back to Roy Dennis, he made a lot of trips to Norway to observe the Norwegian beavers out there and talked a lot about that Ham Fen project. So again, if you want to find out a little bit more about that, I urge you to read Restoring the Wild. It's a great book.
Yeah. Do you want to kick us off with a project that you found?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of projects. There's a Cornwall beaver project, which was started in 2017. A lot of these are obviously fenced projects. In fact, virtually all of these are fenced projects. They were started in, that was started in 2017, demonstrating habitat creation and biodiversity gains and a good breeding success as well. Scottish beaver trial in Knapdale in Scotland. That started in 2009, actually, leading beavers to becoming a protected species in Scotland. The big, really important one is the one in Purbeck in Dorset.
Yeah.
And that is the very first licensed, unfenced wild release in England. But that was only March of this year, 2025, yeah. Which signals a massive shift towards managing wild populations with community support. The South Downs, I'm really pleased to hear, because obviously I live on the South Downs. National Trust project releasing beavers in a fenced area to create wetlands, which has been successful. Forest of Dean's another good area. A fence trial in 2018, monitoring dam building and impacts on habitat. And this one I think is great. Ealing Beaver Project in London.
This is an urban project
showing how beavers can help manage water and boost nature in cities, which I think is a great one. We could do a whole episode about these reintroduction projects, but there's been some really successful ones.
I mean, the one that I wanted to give a bit of a shout out because it involves Norfolk Rivers Trust. Yeah. So obviously, I feel like it's been a while since I've given the Rivers Trust a bit of a shout out.
I don't think you mentioned it in the Curlew episode.
There was a little period where every single episode it got a mention, but it's been a little while.
It's good to hear it. So it's good to have it back.
Yeah, so this is a Norfolk Rivers Trust project, obviously with some partners as well, but it was the Rivers Trust I wanted to give the shout out to, and it was on, and I actually, again, and my mum laughs at the fact that I mispronounce everything, like, what was it, Berkshire?
You said Berkshire, yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like, it looks like it should be.
Yeah, but I was saying Derby instead of Derby or something like that. So the River Glaven is what I would say. G-L-A-V-E-N.
Glaven. I said Glaven.
Glaven. River Glaven. Okay, we'll go with that. In North Norfolk is one of the sort of precious chalk streams that we have. And I think I have mentioned chalk streams, but there are only about 220 in existence. And England has about 80% of the world's chalk streams. So they're really rare. And really diverse in the biologies that they support, things like water voles, white-clawed crayfish, dragonflies, all sorts. They're incredible habitats. However, a lot of them, like all of our rivers, are under a lot of threat and a lot of pressure. And despite the ecological sort of importance of the Glaven, it faces loads of threats from all the things that our rivers do, you know, pollution, climate change, over-abstraction, general nature decline, and things like that, habitat loss. And so in September 2021, after going through all the feasibility assessments that we've alluded to, Norfolk Rivers Trust and their partners released a pair of Eurasian beavers into a secure enclosure at the headwaters of the river. And the reason why I wanted to give this one a shout out, apart from obviously the name drop of Norfolk Rivers Trust, is that in just 3 years, the transformation that they caused on site was absolutely incredible. The headwaters of this chalk stream have become, and again, it was the word that you used, a thriving mosaic of dams, pools and wetlands. The sort of new complex habitat has genuinely really enhanced the resilience of the whole river and the surrounding landscape. Today, they've actually got a small population of beavers in the enclosure because they've bred successfully over multiple seasons, which is lovely. And they've brought loads of life back to the site. They've got things like otters, they've got sparrowhawks, frogs, toads, rare dragonfly species, tawny owls. And so all of this biodiversity has come back to the surrounding area of the river because of the impact that the beavers have had to create this mosaic of habitats. So obviously now ongoing is lots of monitoring around the impact that the beavers are having. There's quite a lot of collaborative research going on with organisations like University of East Anglia. For example, there was a 3-year study at the site and it's already shown a 43% reduction in nitrate levels and a 51% reduction in phosphate levels downstream of the beaver wetlands compared to upstream of the beavers.
Absolutely incredible.
So that's a massive, considering how big of a problem nitrates and phosphates are in algae. Yeah. Blooms. And again, Norfolk is obviously a very heavily agricultural dominant part of the country. Things like nitrates and phosphates are a real problem for rivers. And yeah, 51% reduction in phosphates downstream of beavers, which talks to that sort of pollutant filtering sponge property of their dams.
I think also it does show for all of the sort of opposition to the reintroduction of beavers and the arguments against them being here, there are so many benefits that outweigh those arguments. Yeah. There really are. I mean, I've got a very similar... Sorry.
Just quickly before we move on, one of the parts of this project that I thought was really interesting and important to mention, because it doesn't always get picked up in reintroduction projects, but the enclosure with these beavers has become a really, really valuable resource for educating the public and people about beavers, talking to them about their sort of capabilities, but also some of the challenges they can present. Essentially, this project has had people, well, they've had farmers, they've had school children, they've had community members, partner organisations come see the enclosure and learn about the impact that beavers can have on the surrounding environment. So they've become a real educational resource to, again, like I mentioned earlier, they've been absent from the UK for so long. A lot of us have forgotten beavers, and it's really important to bring them back.
Yeah.
On top of that, again, not this project specifically, but they're quite useful sort of eco-tourism thing. People will travel to see beavers. But it's really brilliant to see these projects not only benefiting the environment, but kickstarting the education that farmers and landowners and people need.
That's a fantastic thing.
So that people grow up understanding how important they are.
That's a great outcome. I've got a very similar project in Cropton Forest in Yorkshire, but there's a little bit that I really like on this one. The main aim of the project was a five-year trial was to see how beavers interact with man-made woody dams in the area. And they worked with researchers from universities of Leeds, Hull, Teesside and Exeter. And there was an ecologist called Kath Bashforth who explains the benefits that they've witnessed so far. And there's some really good stuff in here. The changes to the environment have been amazing. There were two old ornamental fish ponds on the site, which had become very shaded, very silted up. And the top pond was holding very little water. The beavers set to work straight away. They plugged the leaks in the ponds and the water levels of both ponds have risen by over a metre. They coppiced many of the trees overhanging the pond and they opened it up to much more light. And the beavers' work has resulted in a record amount of amphibians recorded on the site in recent years. Previously, just 6 clumps of spawn have been recorded in the area. Now the amount of spawn is totally uncountable. There's so much
of it.
That's
incredible.
Because of the increased numbers of frogs and toads, herons have now regularly been seen fishing around the pond. Otters and tawny owls have been caught on camera feasting on amphibians. Teal and mandarin ducks have been spotted on the site for the first time because of the increased water levels. But why, this is the bit I really like. In addition to their work on the ponds, the beavers have built a large dam 70 metres wide.
Oh.
And this has significantly raised water levels upstream, enabling them to burrow into the banks and create an underwater entrance like we talked about earlier. But now they've extended this dam across the floodplain to hold back even more water. And the river here is now at least 4 times wider than it was, which has obviously helped to mitigate floods. But I like this bit. As yet, the beavers have been swimming past the man-made woody structures and been concentrating on their own dams.
They probably built better ones anyway.
I'm thinking, what's that? I'm not going in there. That's a flipping cowboy build, that is.
They are the experts.
Yeah, they are the experts.
Dam building.
Going in that shoddy bit of workmanship. Every one of these projects, bar none, has just recorded the amazing biodiversity that has increased.
And I would never have thought you bring beavers back, tawny owls would suddenly appear. And it's just, again, benefits
incredible.
All sorts.
So,
I know you spoke about the Cornwall Beaver Project. Did you mention the wildlife that came back after it?
No.
Okay, I might just hop back into that then. Yeah, so just really quickly, I know you've already mentioned the Cornwall Beaver Project, the one that you sort of started on where they were released in 2017.
Yeah.
But because we've been talking about the animals that come back, I just wanted to give this one a shout out because, again, surprising impacts where, I mean, they found 11 species of foraging bats. And again, you wouldn't think of...
Incredible. No, you wouldn't think
bringing
of that.
Bringing a beaver and impacting bats. 7 species.
That's amazing.
11 species of foraging bats. Also, 17 species of dragonfly and damselfly. Brown trout in pools have more than doubled in size since beavers have come back. And so I just wanted to hop back into that project because, again, bats were another surprising one. And I also love the fact that after being released, the dam building began after 2 nights. So they should just like, right, let's get to it.
Let's get on it.
They don't hang about. They're
amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we could easily have done a whole hour just going through these projects because it's so lovely to see them popping up all over the place. And obviously, we always shout out organisations like the RSPB and stuff like that. But you can't do this whole episode without speaking about the Beaver Trust because they are instrumental in all of this work. Again, we talk about how lovely it is to come across organizations whose sole focus is on a species. We've covered quite a few of them now, but the Beaver Trust, their website,
it's fantastic.
The work that they do in partnership with other organizations.
I might have to get a car sticker.
Yeah, they are brilliant. They're often working alongside, obviously, I've mentioned the Rivers Trust, but also local wildlife trusts.
Yeah. The wildlife trusts are doing a huge amount of work as well, and they're always amazing.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot. And I'll link it in the show notes. Quite a lot of the projects that I found was just from a Wildlife Trust website where they listed,
yeah,
I was just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 beaver projects. That
and actually
in.
Those projects, there is a website called Rewild at Heart. We'll put a link on, and they've got a fantastic interactive map where you can see all of the projects, and you can click on all of the pinpointed projects and get a whole whole information about what's going on with those. That's a really good little resource. Yeah. And Rewilding Britain as well is another good website which is talking a lot about beaver reintroduction. So this, we'll put all these links in the show notes because there's so much good stuff. And you know, who's not going to love a beaver?
Yeah, they are just phenomenal. And hopefully if you weren't already convinced, hopefully we've convinced you that they are incredible from their insane adaptations and to the incredible impact that they have on their environment. So there's no other animal that you release and suddenly it just changes the whole landscape and benefits everything around it. And the thing I think we always need to drill down, so we've spoken so much about the benefits to other wildlife, boosting, you know, habitats for amphibians, to improving food for birds, but they really do benefit us as well. We mentioned it slightly in the environmental or the engineering section, but the flood defense, the drought mitigation, reduction in pollution, all of that is hugely important for us as well. So it is not a sacrifice from us to boosting biodiversity. It boosts everything and helps us mitigate the impacts of climate change as well. And cleaner water reduces pollution.
Yeah, it's just a win-win, isn't it?
Phenomenal. And, you know, it needs to be done because of how much change that we've sort of put on the land and how we use the land. It has to be done in a carefully monitored way so that carnage doesn't but if it can be done, and it definitely can be in a sustainable, well-managed way, the benefits that they bring to the whole ecosystem and the communities around is absolutely massive. And they are a lot cheaper than flood defense systems and more effective.
As I alluded to, we've spent £26 billion on flood defenses.
Release the beavers Maybe that should be the title of the episode, Release the Beavers.
I like that title. I think we'll use that.
Anyway, I don't know how long we've been talking.
We're an hour and seven.
Oh, it's not too bad,
less a few edits, you
know. I did go down the rabbit hole of the giant beavers and their evolution, but it was just fascinating.
So much good stuff to talk about.
We'll leave all sorts of interesting links if you want to go and learn even more about beavers and go and support some of the projects and things like that. But otherwise, thanks for listening, I guess.
Thanks for listening. It's been a really good episode. I'm now going to make it an absolute point of going and seeing if I can see a beaver in one of these projects somewhere. There's some there quite close to me. I need to go and see a live beaver.
I'd love to see a live beaver in the UK.
So that's going to be my mission. But yes, thanks very much for listening. I hope you've really enjoyed that episode as much as we did.
Yeah, and obviously all the normal stuff, don't forget to go and find us over on Instagram at the Birdie Bug Pod, and hopefully we'll catch you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.